WWS2N. When it comes to sending a man to Mars, even if he's only being put in orbit and not coming down to the surface, the greatest amount of time is the transition. You're going to move something like 300 million miles between Earth and Mars in order to get there. That's a lot of distance, a lot of exposure time, a lot of food, a lot of consumables have to be accounted for, a lot of radiation exposure. When you put that all together, in my, in your lifetime, and even the lifetime of our children, I'm having trouble believing that we're going to see a man, a human being, transported by whatever means to the vicinity of Mars, even if he doesn't go down and land on the surface. So I'm very skeptical about that one, as you can tell. Let me drop it. But distance-wise, the moon is 250,000 miles one way, as opposed to something like 300 million miles one way to Mars, with the usual geometry of where Mars is and where Earth is at the time you launch and the time you get there and so on. For a whole bunch of reasons, you don't just wait until Mars and Earth are as close as they can and then zip from one to the other. It would take a tremendous amount of energy to do that. There's a much lower energy orbit that you take, which is much longer in distance. There's a trade-off there. So, the moon is 1,000 times closer, many thousands of times easier. Of all the plans you know of all the countries on planet Earth, who is now even speculating that you know of, Paul, of putting something on the surface of the moon? In other words, beginning colonizing of the moon, putting some kind of a habitat there, digging below the surface to get stable temperatures, or building a habitat that can tolerate the temperatures because it's got super reflective surfaces, and it can tolerate the moon's high noon temperatures of a couple hundred degrees Fahrenheit. Who is proposing a moon colonization step, and how soon are they proposing to do that? Was it China speaking about that? Was it Elon Musk? Who is proposing moon? So when it comes to a major effort beyond the International Space Station, as you can tell, I'm guessing it's moon. You're not going to put a man in synchronous orbit. You're going to dive through that distance in order to get to the moon. There's no advantage of putting a man in synchronous orbit 22,300 miles up. Space shuttle could have never gotten there. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a bolt.
Well, China has definitely got plans on doing it. But not really. The question, who's going to be closest, who has a better chance of doing it? Well, now that Russia has come out with these plans, apparently they're funding the first couple of missions already. Like I said, it's going to be, the first one's going to be called the Lunar 25. So, you know, they left off at Lunar 24. And that's going to be a polar landing mission, unmanned. For many years, they're looking at, this is like a system, their proposals for all these different flights. Then they're going to have a lunar globe orbiter, and that'll be Lunar 26. And then they're going to follow that with, instead of the north pole, they want to land one on the south pole. There'll be a south pole landing, Lunar 27, Lunar 28. Will be a sample return mission. 29, I think, is also a sample return mission. And then after that, they'll be pushing for manned missions. So you're looking at, by the time you actually send a man from Russia to the moon, probably 2029. That's what they were predicting. What I read. So now you got China. They got the same idea. They have all these different flights laid out. But whether they make 2029 building, they're actually building it now, so within a couple of years you might see that. So they got a shot at doing it. If the government wants to fund these ideas with like orbital ATK, I mean, let's say they decide to fund it. Orbital ATK says that they could be ready for, Cygnus spacecraft that would be, able to be converted to a regular habitat for a lunar, they call it cislunar, well, I call it lunar orbit, within 3 years. The problem is getting it there. They would probably need a bigger rocket than what they're using. Most likely, they have to probably use a Falcon 9 Heavy or possibly an Atlas 5. So all these plans have to be worked out. But yeah, they can get them there without people, with current rocket technology. With people, that's different. You got to get NASA on board. NASA would then send people to dock with these things in lunar orbit with the Orion spacecraft, and you'd have your habitats waiting there. And essentially, it's a lunar space station, and send four people there and have continuous flights of Cygnus cargo vessels going out there and resupplying these four people. I often wonder, suppose they need a dentist, I cracked a tooth not too long ago. What if they train their astronauts to fix teeth? I mean, there's a lot of things that can come up, never mind Mars orbit, even in lunar orbit, that, you'd like to get the astronaut back as soon as possible. Back to you, Dick, WST.
Yeah, it seems like you and I remember reading about the scientist female who was sent to the South Pole, and I think she ran into an inflamed appendix. If I remember correctly, she was there during the South Polar winter, and she either had to operate on herself, or was there another situation of a person who developed a cancer, a breast cancer. I think it was a breast cancer. And she had to do her own biopsy and possibly a little bit of operating. Do you remember that incident where a physician, female, South Pole, developed a medical condition and she had to do most of the procedure on her own body? WSQN, K2RIW, ring any bells?
Oh, yeah. And, she was successful at that. Actually, they got somebody there to help her, even though she was a doctor. They needed this other somebody to help in the procedure. Now that didn't get her out of the woods because everything was positive. And now she had to wait for a flight, and they did send one in as early as possible. I think they got in month and a half earlier than they would have liked. It's a certain time frame. And they flew her back, and I think she was from Ohio. And got her back in time to go through all the procedures, whatever. I don't know if she went through chemo or whatever, but whatever that was. I believe that was successful. But now, suppose you're in lunar orbit or Mars orbit, something comes up. I'm sure they have these people trained to do a lot of stuff, but, they talk about having doctors work, robotically. But you really can't do that, I mean, they do that here on Earth, but even if there's a 2-second delay from here to the moon, even if they come up with something like that, I think they need a quadrologist, they need an eye doctor, they need all these different physicians to be on these space stations with these people in case something comes up, plus all the equipment that they need to bring with them. I mean, you can't bring an MRI, that's too heavy, right? In fact, you did.
The things that we take for granted these days, you and I have had root canals, tooth implant, bone restoration. I mean, the modern procedures that we have just in dentistry, we've come a long way. It wasn't more than 100 and some odd years ago that you had an infected tooth that needed to be removed. You went to a barber who, with a pair of pliers, took that tooth out of your mouth, with or without anesthesia. I'm not sure which. Boy, we've come a long way. The good news is we've got some rather good medical procedures that can handle a lot of situations. And the amount of grief we suffer these days is a hell of a lot less than in olden days. However, the resources required to supply those pieces of technology are Earth-based. And just like you said, let me drop. How in the world do you establish that on a long space flight? That's why NASA has had to choose extremely healthy people where they believe they're not going to run into an appendicitis or a gallbladder or whatever procedure while they're on the mission. And when you take a mission that's going to be multiple years to go to Mars, no matter how careful you choose the person, and you're going to have a number of people, at least one of them is going to run into a problem. And therefore, that's another reason why I'm having trouble believing we're going to send a man to Mars, even within the lifetime of our children. All of our children are dreaming about the fact that in their generation, there's going to be a man on Mars, and they hope it's one of their friends. It's a good thing to dream about. Right now, I don't think it's a reality unless we make some huge breakthroughs in human habitation procedures, thrusting procedures, and so on. We have to make some huge breakthroughs in batteries, solar cells, thrusting, life support. We got a long way to go. Moon first. Colonizing the moon, there's a bunch of advantages of doing that. Doing optical or radio astronomy. Let me drop it. Doing optical or radio astronomy from above the atmosphere gives you a lot of advantage. To be on a hard, flat surface like the moon makes life a lot easier. You can set up a much steadier telescope. You can put it on the backside of the moon from the Earth and therefore shield it from the light and noise, radio noise from the Earth, and therefore you can make a much more sensitive optical or radio astronomy or ultraviolet or infrared or whatever. So, colonizing the moon, I think, is the next major step after the International Space Station. So, it looks like a number of nations are at least in the talking phase. Do they make any rough guesses as to how soon? Are we talking about 1920, 1925? When's the next time that somebody's going to put something on the surface of the moon which is capable of possible human habitation? What, if you got any speculation on that, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Russia wants people by 2029, you know, so that's... And they have all these lunar... missions before that, you know, unmanned missions. But eventually, as they develop their Federation spacecraft, you know, the Federation is the name that they are giving their new development of a spacecraft to replace the Soyuz spacecraft, since they've been using, you know, since the 1960s. All right, you know, there's been many iterations and improvements over the years of the Soyuz spacecraft, but it's still not a large spacecraft. The Federation is I don't see a date, predicted date that they plan on doing it. They've got other missions as well planned. They're going to be tied up with the space station for a while, or they are going to launch another unmanned spacecraft to the dark side of the moon. They do have plans of doing that. That should be coming up within probably a year or two. Let me drop it. WS2I. You have people like Elon Musk that want nothing to do with the moon. They're planning on going to Mars. And right now, NASA's not jumping on the moon bandwagon yet. We'll see how this development takes hold that Orbital ATK is proposing. See if NASA bites at that, then you might see NASA involved. At best, they could have a United States presence in orbit around the moon. People would be able to use it from the European Space Agency. They have big desires of landing people on the moon. They just have no way of getting there. They keep trying to make plans with Russia, and then Russia eventually turns them down. They want to do it on their own. So they're going to need help. Maybe they could get involved with NASA. They are providing the propulsion system for the SLS for the and the Orion spacecraft. What we used to call the service module. They are building that. So I think with that, they might get an astronaut or two to go with NASA. But there's no planned landings right now by European Space Agency. I know they have intention of setting up a base, but there's nothing there that I see that is making them qualified or ready. Believe it or not, India has long-term plans of going to the moon. This week they're launching a suborbital flight testing what I'm going to call a space plane out there, very similar to the X-37B, the one that the Air Force, our Air Force, has launched four different times. It spends a year or so in space, and then they eventually come back and land on the runway at Vandenberg Air Force Base. But India is launching that. They have long-term plans. They have a crewed vehicle that they've been working on, but that's probably a couple of decades out, I'm going to guess. I'm going to guess Russia will be next, the way I'm reading it. Back to you there.
Okay, you did say that they're speculating that they might be doing that by the year 2029. At first, that sounds like a very big number. However, that's roughly 13 years from now. If you and I make sure we eat enough vegetables, control our weight, get enough exercise, get enough sleep, the chances of you and I being around 13 years from now, I think, are pretty good, Paul. I've got a couple of aches and pains, but I still climb towers, still fix antennas. So in 2029, I think I'll be around to see that. I want to make sure I'm around for the year 2018 to start seeing the operation of the James Webb Super Large Infrared Telescope a million miles away from Earth on the backside of the moon, so to speak. A million miles away. And with such a huge mirror and infrared, which is so good at penetrating dust clouds and whatever, guarantee it's going to start resolving all kinds of nova, supernova, black holes, binary, neutron stars, black holes, looking directly at exoplanets, measuring the atmospheres of exoplanets. If that thing does half of what we think it's capable of, it's going to be making some great breakthroughs. astronomy has really let us know where we stand. Let me drop it. Where we stand in this solar system, this galaxy, this galactic group, and this universe. Where do we stand? And I think you and I are starting to read that the current number of exoplanets is now, depending on which article you read, it's either 3,000 or 4,000 exoplanets. We used to think a planet going around a star is once in a million probability. Back in the days when we were looking at the Drake equation, and all of a sudden we're finding out that essentially every single star has planets, in most cases multiple planets. What we're starting to find out, though, is the number of rocky planets like the Earth inside of the Goldilocks zone around a star is a relatively small number, maybe only 1% or 2%, something like that. It's not a, in other words, the desirable planet in the desirable location, desirable size, desirable location, desirable star, that's a relatively rare event. Maybe 1% of the stars have that. And of those planets we've discovered so far, it looks like the Earth is ahead of most of them as far as the amount of time it's been there and the amount of biological production that has been taking place. This planet of ours is 4.5 billion years old, but it took quite a few millions of years before life started forming. Let me drop. So here we are, roughly 4 billion years downrange on this particular planet before you get man-like animals. Man-like animals have only been around for maybe a million years out of 4.5 billion years of the life of this planet. And how many of those exoplanets in the Goldilocks zone have had the time to do that? An extremely small number of the ones discovered so far. There's a slim possibility of all the life that's out there that we're at the leading edge of that life. A hell of a lot of those other desirable exoplanets have not yet had the time to come up with the kind of life that we're interested in. There's a slim possibility that we're ahead of the pack. I don't accept that. From my point of view, when we study the size of our star, the size of our solar system, the position we are in this solar system, the size of our galaxy, the position we are in this galaxy, the size of our local galactic group, the size of our galaxy compared to the rest of the galactic group, the size of our galactic group and galaxy compared to all the rest. From my point of view, what little I know, we appear to be in the middle. I used to say, of all the life that's out there, I used to believe that half of it's ahead of us and half of it's behind us in technological progress. Maybe what we're discovering is that we're not in the middle in technological progress. Maybe we're near the leading edge. You got to be careful with that. It's very easy to get arrogant and start thinking that, hey, we're the biggest thing around. Let me drop. I'm kind of skeptical of that. Because up till now, we haven't been given a great deal of special consideration. A mediocre star, a mediocre location, a mediocre location of our planet around that star, a mediocre location halfway between downtown and the suburbs of this galaxy, a medium-sized galaxy, medium-sized galactic group. We're in the middle of everything. That may be a very desirable position, but we're in the middle. That used to make me believe that half of all that life out there is ahead of us and half behind. But maybe that's not what it's going to be. But my impression now, with all that we're doing with Mars and many other planets, an awful lot of our spacecraft, and things like Kepler and Hubble and Webb, are one of the major goals of all of this is to look for other life. Are we the only life as we know it in this solar system? Of the billions and billions, you've got 300 billion stars in this galaxy. Let me drop. 300 billion stars in this galaxy. Roughly 1% of those stars appear to have a Earth-like planet in the Goldilocks zone. So if we talk about probability of life in just this galaxy, we're talking about billions of probability planets with life. So we've only just started really scratching the surface of this investigation of where is the exo-life, the life beyond this solar system. We know very little so far. When Drake first made his equation, with the numbers he was plugging into that Drake equation for the probability of life, by our current standards, he was using very pessimistic numbers. He started off believing only one star per million had planets. We now realize that essentially every star has got planets. So, life is getting more and more probable as we gather more and more data. That's about the way you see it, Paul, but you also see it the same way that, in other words, one of the high probabilities, one of the high goals of NASA on many of their adventures right now is really the search for life. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
You gotta find out how it is. Even with the Mars rovers, you know, they would love to confirm that something exists even now on Mars, although they're going to have a hard time to, you know, finding some kind of confirmation. Now there's methane in the atmosphere and where this is coming from, and so they pinpoint something. And then, you know, did it start independently? Or did it, you know, was it transferred from Earth, just like some of the meteorites are transferred from Mars to here? They'll have to exclude that. Maybe if they go out to Enceladus out in the Saturn system, you know, it's most likely a nice planet with water underneath. You know, they've seen streams of water coming out of the surface using the Cassini spacecraft, which has been in orbit since 2004. It's only got another year or so left before they deorbit that into the Saturn atmosphere. And they have a planned mission to Jupiter, to Europa. Europa is probably another planet which is worth looking under the ice. You know, what's all the red stuff on the surface of the ice? You know, what's it being caused from? Some kind of life underneath? Well, they have the Europa Clipper that is now a confirmed mission that they'll eventually send out to Jupiter. Let me drop it. And that'll join Juno. Juno will be there this July, July 4th. That will go into polar orbit around Jupiter. But if they can get the, I'd like to see them launch the, I believe it's called the Europa Clipper. Originally it was planned for, to orbit Europa, you know, decades ago. But they realized the radiation from the Jupiter system, you know, Europa is right in the radiation belt, and your spacecraft isn't going to last too long around, you know, orbiting Europa. So what they plan on doing is have it orbit Jupiter and just make, you know, 40 or 50 different passes, very close passes to Europa, and each time they'll be able to take detailed measurements and maybe get some information and look for life that way. So we'll see. With the telescopes, yeah, James Webb in 2018. I'd like to see, well, TESS is going up next year. Let me drop it. test is going to really take over where Kepler has left off. It's got a much wider field of view. It's going to look at closer stars. But the same type of system, it's going to look at the darkening of the stars. You know, the exact same system that Kepler is using. But it's got an interesting orbit. You know, I'm fascinated. It's going to be the first time they're going to use this orbit where it's going to be going out to the lunar location and then back near Earth. But not close enough to Earth to cause a problem. You know, it's still going to be probably 50,000 miles above the surface of Earth, further out than the geosynchronous orbits of the planets. And when it gets nearby, in that 50 or 60,000 mile range, it'll transmit all its data that it got from all the stars. It'll be a little over 13 day orbit, and every time it goes out, it won't be transmitting back to Earth. It'll be doing science, loading up its flash drives, and then every time it gets close by, it'll transmit for a couple of hours. That should be an interesting satellite or telescope. And it's already got a planned launch. In fact, SpaceX is going to be launching that on a Falcon 9 rocket next August in 2017. So a lot of good flights coming up, and a lot of things we'll be talking about.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You are, Dick. You're going to get your science really out of all these robotic missions. K2RIWWS2N. By the way, man traveled to Mars. They plan on increasing the time. I wanted to mention that before. Increasing the time, or rather decreasing the time it takes. Normally it takes, 8 months to get out to Mars. They want to cut that in half by using the SEP system. They call it the SEP. Solar electric propulsion. I call it ion engines, but lately they refer to them as SEP. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Yeah, even if they decrease that by having higher thrust, continuous thrust, and whatever, it's still going to be exposed between Earth and Mars for a good fraction of a year. And they carefully timed each of those lunar missions during the Apollo program to when the sun was quiet. I mean, all you had to do is have a major outburst from the sun. And that atmosphere of ours gives us a tremendous amount, the atmosphere and the magnetic field gives us a tremendous amount of protection. When you're above that atmosphere and above that magnetic field, and all that radiation is hitting your spacecraft, roaring right through the side of that spacecraft and through you, it's going to be doing cellular damage. So any long amount of human exposure in space above our magnetic field has a lot of danger. You're inside the magnetic field when you're in the International Space Station, even though you're above the atmosphere. So a Mars mission has got a lot of danger involved. But when it comes to life, I'm convinced that Mars had life. Let me show you what I mean by that. 4.5 billion years ago, Earth formed. And in the beginning, Earth had a lot of meteorites, comets, all kinds of stuff hitting the planet. The planet had an atmosphere, water, but that atmosphere consisted of nitrogen, carbon dioxide, very little oxygen. In the beginning, microbial life came along. Where did it come from? You can easily speculate that by way of the Stanley Miller experiment. The Miller-Harold-Urey experiment, where they took the inert materials of early life, put it in a test tube, heated one side of it, passed a spark through it, did that for a week, and you make a whole lot of the amino acids. The raw ingredients of life happen spontaneously in an Earth-like environment. So microbial life started forming on the Earth, and eventually you had a whole lot of green slime in the ocean and plankton, and these plant-like animals consumed the carbon dioxide and gave off oxygen. It was those animals, those plant-like life, which eventually was pretty universal throughout the ocean, it created the oxygen that allowed animals to come along. The Earth has, throughout its whole lifetime, had a substantial magnetic field, a substantial atmosphere. That magnetic field is coming from a molten core that's in rotation, that makes the magnetic field. Mars had all of that. It had an atmosphere. It had water. It had a molten core. Had a rotating molten core. It had a magnetic field. The problem is that Mars is further away from the sun, so it's getting less heat input. Mars is a considerably smaller planet. It's got a smaller thermal time constant. Eventually, that core cooled off and hardened, no longer rotating. It lost the magnetic field. Without the magnetic field, which really deflects those solar wind particles that are hitting us continuously at a million miles an hour, and that magnetic field curves those particles so that they hit in the North Pole and the South Pole and create the aurora in Australia. They create the aurora, North Pole and South Pole. But that magnetic field protects you from all of those very high velocity solar wind particles being boiled up by the sun continuously for billions of years. Let me drop this. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Dick. I was just wondering if Paul read, I read an article this week about the photographing of Mars, and evidently the geologists looked at formations, and they had a huge tsunami on Mars at one time, and also the water samples that they have collected contained a high salt content. I wonder if Paul heard that this week. I'm pretty sure that was Mars they were talking about. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead and make comment on that one, Paul.
I haven't read that one. Saying that, I know they believe there was plenty of water at one time, and whether or not it caused they got a tsunami out of it, and they can show this geologically. That's interesting. I'll look for it, John. I'll find that on the computer. But I have to wonder if they did have life, just like the earlier forms of life here. We had all these big animals. We had big dinosaurs all over. Where are the dinosaur bones? Shouldn't curiosity or opportunity or spirit have found at least one little bone, a little rabbit bone or something? That's what I'm wondering about. And yeah, I know about the amino acids, but we have to get the biologists to work a little further here on Earth to try to get those amino acids to actually develop some kind of, cells that could reproduce. We're missing a step. If they could show that in a lab and put that together, then you could say probably conclusively that there's got to be life out there somewhere that was started independently. That's what I was thinking about when you were talking about it before, Dick. I'll look at that, John. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let me show you where I'm going with this. Earth had all the same conditions as Mars. Mars had all the same conditions of Earth in the beginning. Water, atmosphere, magnetic field, reasonable temperature, a little bit colder than the Earth. I'm convinced that with all those raw materials, microbial life did form on Mars. Now, did it get a chance to go to higher forms by the normal process of evolution? Because Mars is smaller in diameter, it cooled off faster. Because it's further away from the sun, it cooled off faster. when the core finally cooled off and is no longer molten and no longer rotating, you lose the magnetic field. Without the magnetic field, the continuous solar wind is not being hit, not being deflected by that magnetic field where it creates the aurora. That magnetic field, that solar wind is now peeling away your atmosphere. So that beautiful atmosphere and the water vapor in that atmosphere is all being peeled away by the solar wind from the sun that's not being deflected by a magnetic field. As such, let me drop it. Rather early in the Mars history, it lost the magnetic field, lost the atmosphere, lost the moisture. All of that erosion and all of those stream beds and whatever that we see on Mars tells us there was a lot of water there once. You only have that water there when you have an atmosphere. Without the atmosphere, the water evaporates. So they had atmosphere, they had water, they had the raw ingredients of life. I'm convinced that microbial life had no choice but to form on Mars. But now, here we are, 4.5 billion years downrange, no magnetic field, losing the atmosphere, losing the magnetic field, losing the water. You see the results of where the water used to be. The microbial life that was once there doesn't leave you much of a fossil. If it doesn't get to a high enough form of life that really has bones, which have got some, you know, millions of years of possible preservation, microbial life sitting on Mars, you try to find evidence of it. And that microbial life has got very small skeletons, not very much of a solid skeleton. Let me drop it. Those skeletons have been exposed to 200, 300, 400 mile an hour winds of a very, very sparse atmosphere, continuous bombardment by solar wind particles, ultraviolet rays, and whatever. The chances of you finding the remains of the microbial life that I'm convinced did form on Mars. Here you are, X number of million or billion years downrange, looking for these tiny fossils of microbial life. That's a tough one. So to find evidence of Mars that didn't get a chance to go far enough to form animals that gave you bones that had some preservation to them. And even if there are bones there, with those very high winds, they're being buried very deep. I mean, if I simply dropped a spacecraft down on Earth and looked for bones to prove what kind of early life the Earth had, I'm going to have to do an awful lot of research before I start finding bones and start putting enough of them together to start drawing a picture of what life on Earth was like. Let me drop. So even if you had bones on Mars, there's not going to be anywhere near as many of them as on Earth, because I don't think the life got a chance to go that far before it lost all raw ingredients. And so, for a whole lot of years, it's been hitting with ultraviolet, solar wind particles and whatever, chewing everything up, high winds burying it in the dust. So finding life evidence on Mars is pretty tough. We may find it. I think we're going to have to dig pretty deep. And, Curiosity is doing a real good job right now, and a bigger version of Curiosity, I think, is being built, and is going to be launched roughly how soon, Paul? It's going to have a more elaborate laboratory to do life search.
Good comment, Dick.
Yeah, let me ask Paul on that one first. WS2N, K2RIW, and then pass it over to John.
Yeah, that'll be 2020. They call it the 2020 rover. They haven't given it a name yet, but that's good to go. I believe that one's going to go. And it's going to have a very similar landing system that Curiosity did. The weight is the same. You're right. It's going to be a much more modern vehicle. It's going to be... it's going to have very sensitive detectors, instruments on board, no question about it. It's just the same weight. It's not going to physically be bigger. John, over to you. WS2N.
KC2WGB. You know, also, Dick, you also look at the fact that life on Mars may have ended, but the geological activity may have continued post-life, and therefore they could be buried extremely deep that had very large volcanoes or earthquakes and things like that. So that's another thing why we might have trouble finding stuff.
Yeah, I'm convinced it's there. It had no choice but to form because the raw ingredients were there. And as we know it, the Harold Urey Stanley Miller experiment proves to us pretty strong evidence, almost proof. With the raw ingredients and enough time, the amino acids form, early life will form every time. Has no choice. This was TechNet number 1603. That was Space Report number 202 of the series. We've used up our time for tonight. We're going to settle many of these issues next week, it says here. Right, Sean? We're going to come to the conclusion of all these things. These open issues are all going to be closed. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And keep all your cards and letters coming and your questions. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yes. Keep those questions coming and the comments. They're well appreciated. And that's what this net's all about. I want to thank everybody for participating and hope that you join us next week. And be kind to each other and have fun. It's a great hobby. Paul, over to you, sir.
Very good. I'm going to look for that tsunami on Mars. Maybe that washed everything away. You're right. All the geology that went on. I'll look for the article, John. Good night, 73. John, have a good night. Dick, you too. K2RIWWS2N.
We're slowly educating each other. We think we are. Maybe it's the blind leading the blind. What do you think, John?
Could be. All I know is I'm not going to Mars because they don't have cappuccino there. So I'm not going.
They don't have the right brand of pizza. I'm not going to go. What's going to stop you from going, Paul?
Burger King.
You're right. You remember that. I looked down at with the high-rise telescope from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and all the thousands of pictures, close-ups. You could see the size of a coffee table. Not one cow on the surface. No Burger King. Very good, John. You remember. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, guys, don't forget, look tonight. Mars is at a great point for viewing. It's just to the right of the moon, from what I understand, and it's the closest it's going to be in a few years, I believe. You would know more, Paul. But take a look. When I go out there, I'm going to take a look also.
Yeah, I've been watching the moon rise out of my window. We've got a nearly full moon tonight. And I guess Mars is just a few degrees off of the moon. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, I know which night it was. I forgot. We talked about that on the Astronomy Net, and Craig does a good job with that. And that was actually brought up. So we'll look for that. And in fact, he was talking about the tilt of Mars. If you look through the telescope, well, I can't do it. It just looks like a bright star. It's not flickering for me. But if you look at it, the degree of tilt in relation to what we're looking at is 6 degrees. He had all that information. It's a 25 degree normal tilt, just like we're 23 and a half. But he had the what it would look like if you look through a telescope, where the pole would be tilted. So I don't know. I don't have a good enough scope for that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Mars has an orbit that's tilted somewhat like the Earth, but in celestial coordinates, the exact angle that it's tilted, what the North Pole of Mars, is it aimed at the North Star? Probably not. It's aimed at some other place. But because of the geometry of where Mars and Earth is right now, they both are within 6 degrees of tilt from each other, another somewhat unusual condition. Now, when it comes to your favorite Burger King, Paul, that apparently is quite important to you. Which one of the Burger King products is your favorite? And do you have one of those once every week or so? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Well, I'm going to go with the Whopper. But, What I mean by that, of course, is you're not bringing any meat with you. If you could grow stuff on Mars, you're going to grow plants and you're going to become a vegetable. Whatever frozen stuff you're going to bring on the trip to Mars, that's it. When that's gone, it's over. So if I go, I'm going to pack up a bunch of frozen Whoppers and bring them with me, and I hope they last for 3 years.
However, Paul, is the Whopper a product of Burger King, or is that a product of the Golden Arches? Who makes the Whopper, Paul?
Oh, that's Burger King. You gotta go for the Big Mac for the Golden Arches.
Okay. And I presume that the Whopper, I presume that's a cheeseburger, multiple layer cheeseburger. Is that what that is?
Oh, no, you can get it with or without, any way you want it. I remember back in the 70s, they even had something called the Big Plain for the people that just they didn't want anything. No pickles, no nothing. They called it the Big Plain, and then you would add things. They did away with that. I always thought that was a good idea. Stop the U.S. plan.
Roughly how many calories is in a Whopper, Paul? And how many grams of sodium, if you happen to know?
Yeah, I know, if you're into
Avogadro's number.
I don't know. I don't remember. I don't know if I want to know. But, calories, I think it's 660 or something like that. Now, when you go to these places, they have it all listed. Everything that you eat, how many calories you're consuming. I hate that word, consuming. There are no calories that you're eating. It's how much heat you have to, how many BTUs that you have to burn to get rid of the stuff that you ate. People think they're really eating calories.
How often do you have a Whopper? Once a week? Twice a week? It sounds like it's a lot of fun. How often do you have one of those, Paul?
We're losing it. Okay. As I got older, they shrunk. I go with the junior Whoppers now. I don't know if you could copy it. I think we lost the repeater.
Oh, we're hearing you fine. Do you eat one or two Whoppers per week, or two or three junior Whoppers per week?
I'll average maybe one a week, depending how things are going. But and then McDonald's is good. Burger King by me is good. They're all over the country, of course. But you were talking about the salt. You can't go near that. Now me, I don't have that problem. I was tested for salt years ago, and it didn't change my pressure when I cut it out 100% for a long period of time, so I got the go ahead.
Yeah, my particular body chemistry or genetics of my family history is such that salt creates a couple of strange effects.
Repeater, time out.
Out, and do you do it once a week?
Basically, maybe once a week, sometimes once every 2 weeks. I like Wendy's. They have some nice salads, and they have some great burger stuff. They also have like a Sausalito chicken, a little spicy, but good stuff. I like it a little better than Burger King.
So you're not a Whopper enthusiast. The call hasn't gotten to you yet.
Well, I've had them, and they're pretty good. The only thing is, they're awful big. So maybe the Junior's a better thing. I can't even finish a whole Whopper. That's a lot of food.
Was it Burger King that used to have the... Was it Burger King that had that open salad bar in the old days?
Channel 17 from Philadelphia, and I got Channel 17 from